May Brussel is next with Dialogue Conspiracy.
That's Elmer Davis. This is the May and Elmer Hour. Huh? Does he look like a scapegoat to you, Bill? Does he look like a scapegoat? He just ordered some stationery. Elmer Davis, scapegoat for the world's most famous robbery.
You're on. Oh. Right now?
Oh,
time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist May Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's May.
Good afternoon. Pardon me. Dialogue Conspiracy, Monday, October 21st. This is number 167 in the program, and I was just cracking up. We were a minute late on the air. We were talking here in the room. I usually do the show by myself, but I have a special guest today, and he's going to do the show with me, or part of it. We'll cover some of the news of the week, and then you're going to have the pleasure of hearing Elmer Davis. There was an article in the newspaper last week pertaining to Elmer Davis titled U.S. Aids Nixon in Suits. The Justice Department confirms their offer to defend Richard Nixon. You know, in the pardon that Gerald Ford gave Richard Nixon, he is not going to court for any of the federal cases, the Watergate cases, but in his civil suits, he is being sued by five parties, and these are to take place in majority of them in California, one South Carolina. The existing cases against Richard Nixon and the Justice Department, one is Jane Fonda versus former FBI Director L. Patrick Gray, A. Alden, Richard Nixon. The other is Elmer Davis versus Richard Nixon, John Sinclair versus Richard Nixon and former Attorney General Richard Kleindienst. Sinclair is the Billy Graham rally where the young people felt their civil rights were abused. They couldn't attend the rally because they had long hair and were hippies. One of them, you remember, was a Vietnam veteran who couldn't, wounded to boot, who wasn't allowed at the rally. And William A.H. Lake is one of the National Security Council persons that was bugged, who's suing Richard Nixon and John Ehrlichman and the Socialist Workers Party. Elmer Davis versus Richard M. Nixon, we'll talk about in just a few minutes, because you'll be hearing a lot about Elmer Davis, and we'll get into that case. There are a few things I did want to bring up, news of the week, before we get into that. Last 2 weeks I did shows on the Ustasi, the group of terrorists that have been formed since World War II, and I'm not going to do any more on them. There was a wire service, well, at least not for a while, a wire service about the Ustasi trial taking place in Yugoslavia. It was in the paper yesterday, the Sunday Examiner and Chronicle. A group of terrorists, these are young terrorists that are a second generation group of terrorists that have gone to Yugoslavia to start, in quotes, a civil war. They're killing communist officials, blowing up industrial and military installations, burning forests, and destroying public property. And the article in the paper said they still exist in exile in several countries. They obtain their arms and explosives from abroad. And if you heard the last two shows on KLRB Dialogue Conspiracy, I talked about the Ustasi Yugoslavian connections in California and working with the Los Angeles Police Department. They also work out of Argentina and Sydney, Australia, and Canada. Those are the main places. And I believe that they're behind the terrorist bombings in the United States that we're seeing at the present time, that they're trying to blame the radicals, men like Mr. Kerbekovich in Los Angeles, who belonged, he said, to Aliens of America. Another item in the news, our president, Gerald Ford, is down in Mexico today, Nogales, Mexico. He's allegedly meeting with the president of Mexico over the new oil findings in Mexico, But there's another version that came over the Los Angeles Times by Stanley Meisler, said the CIA and Mexico close association leaves red faces. And there's a new book coming out about the CIA and by Mr. Agee now in London. And he is revealing a lot of the links and the cover of the CIA agents in Mexico City. And this long article in the LA Times this week suggests that the reason Gerald Ford is down in Mexico meeting the president of Mexico this October 21st, 1974, is not about oil findings at all, but what to do about the CIA and those revelations coming out in the new book. This is terribly important because Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission. He hid the conspirators of the John Kennedy assassination. He was involved in concealing the Mexican funding. The assassins came from Mexico City. They were funded by the FBI, the people that killed John Kennedy. The same funding through Houston Foundations touched Leon Jaworski and his CIA foundations down there, the Anderson Foundation in Houston. So it's very important with all of this breaking that Gerald Ford meet with the president of Mexico at this time, and also for Leon Jaworski. There was an article today about Leon Jaworski. Not only did he quit as special prosecutor, but one of the reasons he quit, I got information from Sherman Skolnick in Chicago, was the story breaking on the Dorothy Hunt plane crash and the murder of Murray Chotiner, that he didn't want to be around to investigate those. But today's article has the links of Jaworski and the influence that Haig, General Haig, had over Jaworski. And when the Saturday night massacre came and the members of the Justice Department left the White House in Washington, D.C., they were fired by Richard Nixon. It was General Al Haig, remember, who jumped over 243 colonels to become a general, who moved in Haldeman's place in the White House to guard the president, who got on a telephone and told Jaworski down in Texas, get up here to Washington, I'm sending a plane. Now, this revelation of the closeness of the man guarding Richard Nixon with a special prosecutor, again, goes back to the influence of the Pentagon and the CIA and the hold they have over the government or the cover-ups and the cover stories, because Jaworski is running home without even scratching the surface of the true story of the Watergate. But this is an article from the Los Angeles Times News Service, a quotation of Haig. It says, Haig spoke of the almost revolutionary state of the country and said that he was going to put the patriotic monkey on my back. This is Jaworski talking, that the excuse for having Leon Jaworski come to Washington right away was the revolutionary state of the country. It was in the best interest of patriotic monkey. Now, it's that same patriotic monkey that sat on the back of Gerald Ford that wouldn't tell that the CIA killed John Kennedy. And that patriotic monkey got on the back of Earl Warren, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who cried literal tears because he had to head that fictitious investigation, that Warren Commission. So 10, 11 years later, here is Haig from the Pentagon and the CIA using the same appeal to Jaworski, Ford, Nixon, all involved 10 years ago in Dallas. And the AP wire service, the LA Times, said today they sent a plane for him the next day. In effect, what they said was, get your body here, we need you. And he got on a plane the next day, and the argument was that we were having a revolution in this country. Patriotism is the last resort to covering up all the dirty deals that are going on. We'll talk later. I want to get on to Elmer's story. Well, I just briefly say the Kent State trial is opening up this week. The 8 National Guardsmen are on trial. The Justice Department did nothing on this. The grand jury did nothing where those 4 students were killed. It was private investigators working in Ohio that forced this open. There is a book about the truth of Kent State, the killings we've talked about. This is opening up this week. It's a national disgrace that the federal government never got into the firing and the taking away the civil rights of students to assemble without being shot down. 13 were shot and 4 were murdered. There was another article in the paper today on the Hearst food giveaway. And again, I'm running through these. I just want to let you know they are coming out. One is the story. It's an extortion probe of the food ripoff. If you read my article, and it's still at the Thunderbird here in Carmel and different places, you people who listen to the show regularly must know where to obtain them now. I did the story on why Patricia Hearst was kidnapped. And today's paper has an article about the hiring of 2 black Muslims who were responsible for provoking the riots at the food rip-off when the food was handed out, and the man who brought them into the scene, that went out and reached for these two Muslims to use their empty warehouse and get $99,000 for food that wasn't delivered, an extortion racket. The man behind all of this, his name is Walker. And if any of you are in California, the California people know his name. It came out in the news recently, Charlie Walker, who's a figure in the controversial Sumo Valley golf course deal. It involves organized crime and the mafia. The conspiracy circles that I have, those 15 rings of a conspiracy that make up a conspiracy, consist of different elements, and one of them is organized crime. And these men from the golf course, they're mobsters. This involves Tony Romano, and Walker took off the golf course from Romano. That's a separate story in itself. The fact is that organized crime, working for the CIA and the FBI, reached down to make the fall guys, in this case, the two Muslims, two black Muslims, and they're charging them with extortion of receiving money and not delivering food. The Martin Luther King case is opening up, the James Earl Ray case. Remember, he took it to the Supreme Court. They turned him down 8-0 to not open the case. But it's being opened in Memphis, Tennessee this week. We've talked about it many, many weeks. James Ray claimed that there was a conspiracy. He didn't kill Martin Luther King. And he gave a letter to Judge Battle March 15, 1969, and said that Ramsey Clark wasn't telling the truth, that there was a conspiracy. Clark was the head of the FBI in those days. And just a short while after that, Judge Battle, that same afternoon, was found dead. And then a new judge came on the case and wouldn't open the conspiracy deal. I cross-filed that in the book I'm doing, Murderville, USA, The Murder of a Judge. He had the evidence there was no conspiracy, that the FBI, that was the chief prosecutor, was lying. James Ray told them that. It's going to court, and hopefully it'll come out in the open. Rockefeller's nomination is damaged, right? To Representative Don Edwards at the House Judiciary, or any other member of the judiciary, or the member of the Senate, if you don't want the international banker who's given away $2 million or $22 million, whichever, he'll admit, keep admitting more. But gifts, I've just read he gave a painting of $6,500 to John Mitchell, hands out artworks, and public officials, and I'm sure that in return, they wouldn't go against anything the Rockefellers want, real estate deals, and as a slumlord, and the list of people he gave to is so revealing that his nomination is being damaged. But you can help it along by sending letters and telling them what you think. I also want to do a show on the framing of Wilbur Mills. Watergate isn't over. The Dirty Tricks Department pulled to Wilbur Mills what they did to Ted Kennedy, only the girl lived this time. She claims Fannie Fox, that Argentine firecracker that was in the car with Wilbur Mills, claims that when she got to the river and jumped out of the car, that the police tried to drown her. It sounds like Chappaquiddick, where they succeeded in dropping her. And Wilbur Mills was in a car driven by Albert Capaldi, who happened to have no lights on and was speeding. It was 2 a.m. And Capaldi works for the Nixon administration. He worked in the Interior Department, received $30,000 a year, driving at 2 a.m. with a congressman with a car speeding and no driver's license. And I want to announce that Mr. Cabaldi's been left off without any citation as the driver of that car. As a coincidence, there was a cameraman, a local night roving television cameraman, was on the scene to photograph a policeman apprehending Congressman Mills. The girl said, "I didn't jump into the tidal basin." That's Mrs. Batiste Della. She said, "I got hysterical because the officer was trying to drown me. I'm an excellent swimmer." That little fancy cookie, the firecracker, was a strip teaser for 1 month. She was a school teacher. She was studying general biology science in college, a pre-medical student in Argentina. She was a secretary for Mills, getting no salary. She was an interior decorator with no degree. She's an agent provocateur hired by the Dirty Tricks Department. The cameras were there. She had something in her drink, probably the kind of asset that Liddy was going to give the Democrats down in Miami with John Mitchell. She had something in her food or beverage, went berserk, jumped out of the car, and police tried to drown her. The scene was photographed. And the result is that now Mrs. Batiste Della has moved to Florida with her children. She's got an American citizenship. Her husband still lives in Argentina. So her reward, like Marina Oswald, was probably to get citizenship, and I'm sure she'll be paid off later. And meanwhile, Judy Petty will defeat Congressman Mills, and a Democrat will be out of the running. The girl's alive, but that's the framing of Wilbur Mills. We could go into those details. They're so terribly shocking, but we're going to get on to Elmer Davis because he's sitting here very patiently. There's an article by Attorney General William Saxby last week at the police convention. He was saying that rehabilitation of certain inmates is meaningless, and you should abolish the idea of rehabilitation, that sometimes people commit many crimes and it's impossible to rehabilitate them. We should consequently, he said, strip them of all rights. If they're guilty of crimes, we should just keep them in prison and protect society at large. So Elmer Davis is going to talk to us, and I'm going to talk with him because he is the White House scapegoat. Some of you remember that I mentioned his name before I knew him personally. I talked about him on the radio show. There was a wire service dated July 16, 1973, saying a black inmate in California's Folsom State Prison has filed a $2 million federal court suit against President Nixon and members of his administration, charging they made the inmate the scapegoat and fall guy for the burglary of the office of Daniel Ellsberg, psychiatrist. The suit was filed by 45-year-old Elmer Davis, who was convicted last year of committing the burglary of Dr. Lewis Fielding's office in Beverly Hills, September 1971. Davis is currently locked up at Folsom Prison for allegedly carrying out the Fielding burglary and other break-ins. Three members of the Beverly Hills Police Force testified that Davis confessed to the break-in of the psychiatrist's office, but Davis himself claims that he has consistently denied any knowledge of the offense. Well, I could go on and read the news service. This came out July 16, 1973, and it was in the major newspapers over the wire services. So Elmer Davis realized that he was a scapegoat. It was Mr. Wineglass, Daniel Ellsberg's attorney, who wanted to know who the Beverly Hills police had down on the books for that robbery at the office. How soon after that broke, Elmer, did you get knowledge that you were the scapegoat? This news service is July 16th. What date did you find out you had been named as the scapegoat for that burglary?
I think I had been, I was made aware of the fact that I had been selected as a scapegoat on approximately May, a couple of months before.
A couple of months before it hit the wire service.
Yeah, May the 3rd or 4th.
When the trial was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this is at the time I read an article in, I think, the Sacramento Bee.
Did you read in the paper? Did the law enforcement come and tell you? The FBI or police, or did you have to read the newspaper?
They came... The very first day I was contacted by investigators from Daniel Ellsberg's defense side. And also the following day I was contacted by agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
To tell you that you were a patsy in this thing?
Yeah, that I had allegedly confessed to the break-in of Dr. Fielding's office in Beverly Hills, the Daniel Ellsberg psychiatrist.
When did you read the article that I did on The Realist? How soon was that after the May thing? Did you... Elmer read... I wrote that in July 72, and this was May 73, that you found out you were the scapegoat?
Yeah.
And then you read The Realist article?
Yeah.
I got a letter from Elmer. I have it here because it was the first letter he ever wrote to me, July 30th, 1973. This was just right after, 14 days after that other news service came out, and he said, "Dear Mrs. Bressel, how are you? I do sincerely hope that you are doing fine and that you are in the best of health. A mutual friend of ours sent me a copy of the article you did on Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? I read it. I must say I found it enlightening. I'm in wholehearted agreement with your appraisal of what's going on about us and under our very noses." And he goes on to describe the article, and he says, "I'm a researcher of sorts, and I'm fully aware of the time-consuming effort you must have put into the writing. Without further ado, I must introduce myself. I'm Elmer Davis, a black American presently incarcerated in Folsom Prison, who the Beverly Hills Police Department, the United States government, attempted to use as a scapegoat in the break-in of Dr. Fielding's office, the psychiatrist of Daniel Ellsberg. As you no doubt know, a B.L. Cork, chief of police of Beverly Hills, came out in the newspapers and said that I confessed to the break-in, stating I was looking for narcotics. As soon as, then I would go on to say Elmer wrote me this long letter, and that was the beginning of a friendship. That was July 73, that's a year and 4 months. And I answered that, and that began a correspondence which was going back and forth and pretty heavy. And Elmer just got out of Folsom last Monday. He's been in there for 2 years, and this is the suit we're talking about, Davis versus Nixon. And our correspondence began to escalate after that, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Maybe you want to share the thing about the narcotics, how they came to you. They first, the newspaper said that you confessed the crime, right?
The reason, I guess you're referring to the reason I was selected to, for the, to be the scapegoat is, and I'll try to enumerate a few facts that I think that went into their making the decision to choose me as the scapegoat. Number one, I had filed several lawsuits against the Los Angeles Police Department, and naturally, as a consequence, I wasn't...
You weren't very popular.
I wasn't very popular with them. Number two, the fact that I was black. Three, the fact that I was an ex-narcotic addict with an extensive criminal record. And the fact that I was poor naturally played a very determining role in their selection of me to be the scapegoat. If you recall, I know you do, in your thoroughgoing research of the particular case, Martinez, I think it was, one of the fellows who actually, one of the government selected officials who were actually connected, who actually committed the burglary, rather, mentioned the fact that after they had broken into the office of Dr. Fielding, that they took some vitamin C tablets threw them all over the floor to give the impression that a narcotic addict had actually committed the burglary. Well, in as much as I had previously been arrested in the Beverly Hills area and had a similar M.O., a modus operandi, as it's referred to in legal jargon, they chose me as the ideal scapegoat, feeling that...
Well, see, one of the things I think is so important in the whole case is that Saxby talks about you can't rehabilitate, that these people should be locked up forever. But when you stop doing the burglaries to keep the habit, when you stop the narcotics and began to study law and go down and help with the legal aid and go to the jails and help the people and sue the police department, then you rehabilitate yourself so well that they want to lock you up permanently.
That's true.
Yeah.
You become, become a threat to his position. He might be correct in saying that rehabilitation programs are useless, but not for the reason he stated. It's because him and his ilk on both state and national levels are conspiring to keep people such as I, myself, in to make them patsies and scapegoats in various criminal offenses and then bury them.
You know. And also to keep you from suing the police department. You'd been involved for a couple of years in suing the police department, helping poor with the legal cases. And so with a long history of narcotics arrests and the burglary going with it, they could just put you away. Yeah.
See,
the biggest problem in this country, one of the big problems, I think, is that the blacks have to be aware, and also the whites, that what's happening, that when you do take yourself by your bootstraps and say, well, drugs are a put-down, it's non-political, not revolutionary, which Cleaver said, and I'm going to use my brains because I have as much intelligence as the next guy, the white guy, and they don't have the monopoly on brains. The minute you begin to put your thing together, then they have to plant evidence against you. They don't want you to work in the system. You know, the recidivism keeps the prison business going, and they don't want you to figure out, you know, ways to better yourself, because otherwise they wouldn't charge you for something you didn't do if you're learning to better yourself.
My first reaction, incidentally, May, was one of shock, astonishment. I asked myself the very question that I've been asked several times, numerous times since, why did they select you? But after looking back and viewing this in this proper perspective, those brain that who deal in this type of nefarious conduct, I could easily see why. You know, I met criteria for such a act.
The papers I read in your legal work, you know, you've got such a sharp mind that it'd be very convenient to put you away. You know, like Martinez said in that article in Harper's Magazine, he had fingerprints around there, and because he didn't use rubber gloves in spite of what they said, and yet they charge you with that entry, and they didn't take your fingerprints, and they didn't find any of your fingerprints in Dr. Fielding's office. In fact, you were in the Los Angeles jail at the time, which is one of the basis of your suit, so you couldn't possibly have been near there, you know. But they didn't have fingerprints to show you, that nobody seeing you on the presence. How do they conduct a trial, like in the Santa Monica court? They say, well, you're guilty of these 35 robberies in Beverly Hills, and you were, you know, sent to jail for being guilty for these, and yet, and allegedly confessing without one piece of evidence. People don't know that these things happen in this country. I mean, it's like Juan Corona. I try to say, you know, 25 bodies, and not one piece of evidence that links them to the murders. Well, how do they go? I mean, it's an educational thing. That's what this show is. Maybe you can explain, how do they conduct a trial and charge you with 35 burglaries with no fingerprints, no witness on the spot, no evidence in your place that they've seized, and proof later the chief of police said, well, we didn't even check to see where he was, and yet you went before a judge, didn't you?
I did.
And a jury?
Yeah.
Well, how do they conduct a trial like that? I mean, what is in the jury's mind? I mean, were you your own lawyer at that trial?
That's true.
Well, how do they conduct a trial? How do they get the jury to believe you did it without one piece of evidence?
Well, aside from the evil contact, 10 of such proceedings, the law is structured in California, whereas an issue like that is what they call a factual issue. It depends on who the judge or the jury wants to believe in. And as in my case, when the police officer takes the stand and said that I did it, the fact that I had a previous criminal record
is enough to convict you.
Enough to convict you.
Of 35.
They'll take the police officer without an iota of proof. They'll take the police. As a matter of fact, I presented the issue to a judge and moved to dismiss these cases. And the judge said, well, I said, Your Honor, there's not an iota of the evidence here. And the officer perjured himself under oath. Mm-hmm. And I moved the case be dismissed for lack of evidence. And on the ground, the officer perjured himself. And the judge said, well, said, I'm inclined to believe him.
Believe the officer, off you go to jail.
And in consequence, the jury was one of the prosecutor's favorite type of jury, the hometown jury of
Santa Monica.
Santa Monica.
All white aerospace?
Jury, so they in turn.
Could you select or throw any out in that kind of a case, or do you have to take
it? You have what they call peremptory challenge.
You didn't use any?
I just don't like the person. I used all of them. Uh-huh. In fact, I challenged the whole jury process. When we get the records, incidentally, we're in the process of getting the records. When we get the records show that I challenged the whole jury process in that area on that score of racial discrimination and so forth.
Elmer wanted to get a hold, we have an investigator, to get a hold of the transcript of that arrest there where he challenged the arrest. And it's the Beverly Hills Police Department. And when he called there, we got a call today, the They transferred the chief of police, and there was a hold on his records. Here he's going to trial in this very important case, and he wants his first arrest records to show that he has been confined, also 2 years in prison on all kinds of setups and years before that as a fall guy. But he asked for the chief. They said, we'll get the chief of police. So this investigator got a hold of them, and they would not release it. Is that unusual, not to release the transcript of a trial?
That's very unusual. If you recall, when this first broke and came to the public's attention, the FBI is supposed to grab my records, a copy of them, and took them to the Washington under seal. And they placed a flag or a hole on the record that we seek in Beverly Hills. All this indicates that now, the conspiracy continues to suppress evidence.
So now we have to subpoena. You have to subpoena the chief of police to give you your own trial records where any other person could have it if it wasn't against the chief of police, right?
I had to have the federal court. I had to move for a subpoena to Deuces Tecum and have the federal judges presiding over the bond issue subpoena Deuces Tecum and order them.
Of course, the chief of police you've named in your lawsuit. So he's not going to turn over. He's like Nixon turning over the tapes.
Not more than likely.
Does he have to answer the subpoena?
He definitely does. It'd be cited for contempt or fine.
This is going to get kind of messy, huh?
Oh, as it goes along, it's going to be real messy.
You know, the reason, you know, like I got into this case right away, it caught my interest because, well, like in 1971, just the time that you were being framed, and this was in October 8th, where they said to you, the chief of police or chief of detectives said to you,
about a month after,
confess all this in October.
Yeah.
Yes, 71. Well, just at that time, Lewis Tackwood, the agent provocateur for the Los Angeles Police Department, had a press conference, and he said that there's a secret team inside the White House, you know, this special military team. And one of the men that he was supposed, the code name White, was the name for E. Howard Hunt, you know, in the White House. And the other one was Martin. It later turned out to be McCord. But Tackwood said that it was the FBI and the CIA were linked to the Los Angeles Police Department, and its tentacles went into the Department of Corrections, the Attorney General, Evel Younger, and the whole California law enforcement, that the CIA, the nest of the major conspiracies and things, was linked from Washington White House to the Los Angeles Police Department. So when it turned out that the White House plumbers, like E. Howard Hunt is the name that Tackwood would use if he had hired radicals and framed them, see, they were going to be a fall guy like you're a fall guy, which means that they're capable of it, because that's what Tackwood, he was telling the world at the same time you were being framed about these agencies. So you have E. Howard Hunt out at Dr. Fielding's office at the robbery. You have Tackwood at the time telling about this secret team, but nobody would investigate it. You were in the Los Angeles jail, and the Beverly Hills police were charging you, which makes it a state thing, and then you're sent to a prison for 2 years, and you're in jail several times over on false arrests where stuff is planted against you by a girl out on parole because of your legal knowledge and so forth. So it fit in with the Tackwood allegations, and it made what I was saying on Dialogue Conspiracy up here and thinking and writing about, it confirmed what I said, because here you were a perfect scapegoat, like Oswald or Brammer or Sirhan. You were a scapegoat for the world's most famous robbery.
I'm a living example. If you recall, too, there's another connection. Martinez, in his Harper's article, he refers to the fact that a black and white police automobile at Beverly Hills was trailing them after they immediately upon their leaving the burglary, and he was under the impression that as the CIA worked, that they were there to protect him, not to arrest him. And it's odd.
Absolutely. That's right. So the police car, see, the police did, they ever, first of all, they didn't even check. They had their cover story, you know, like your story fits into my conspiracy chain thing. You know, they had the cover story, there's an attic. Well, anybody who's in a doctor's office looking for drugs, he wouldn't spill them on the floor, would he? I mean, that's he'd take them home and taste them at least to see what they were. The second thing,
addict, they're just like leaving a fingerprint. They say, come and get me, arrest.
That's right. So an addict wouldn't want to call attention to the fact that he's an addict. Yeah,
that's true.
See, it's just like at the Sharon Tate murder. We're talking about that today, where the military intelligence writes deaths of the pigs on the door. Well, if a Black Panther was going to do the murder, he wouldn't leave his trademark on the door. You know, I mean, an addict wouldn't throw pills around, but in their infantile way, like a B movie or something, you know, they leave this. And they, so the police didn't have your fingerprints, and they, but they already had a patsy, a long history of narcotics. So Franklin asked you to confess. Why was he so anxious? He begged you, didn't he, to clear the books?
Yes, he offered me. I was charged the offense that the in this original form with the burglar, which is a felony, and carries 6 months to 15. But they offered me a misdemeanor offense of petty theft if I should be. It was ridiculous because number one, I hadn't did it, but this one I recognized the sinister character of what was about to take place. I said, well, he's very concerned about me.
Covering it.
Yeah. I think for some reason at the time I couldn't pinpoint it. It wasn't the peak. The conspiracy didn't peak to 2 years later.
Yeah.
But then at that very time I knew in this face-to-face confrontation with him, he had some ulterior motive.
For making you say you did 35 burglaries in Beverly Hills.
He insisted. He said, I can give you a petty theft charge. Why don't you please clean up the books? He kept hopping.
Clinging the books.
Yeah, for all the burglaries committed in this general area. But one important note is the fact that no mention was made of the Dr. Fielding's burglary. This is one of the reasons I think they're making it so difficult for me to obtain the original arrest report. So this will further point out the fact that...
How sinister
it was. They wanted to plead guilty, like sign a blank check, and then they can fill in the details of Dr. Fielding's.
But when you wouldn't sign it, they put it in anyway.
Put it in.
And you didn't know it was on your record.
I asked him under cross-examination, why did you get a confession from Mr. Davis? And he said, yes. I said, did you tape it? He said, no. I said, did you have a secretary to transcribe the notes? And he says, no. I said, well, how did you come about this confession? I noticed it's unsigned. He said, I made some notes of it. I said, well, where are the notes? He said, I destroyed him. I said, that's rather convenient, it is to myself, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I made a motion to dismiss.
Well, you know, this is
and
like...
all the facts just point to one thing.
Well, see how it parallels all these conspiracies, like in the Kennedy assassination, like, say, Oswald's, the Patsy, and there were multiple gunmen, and it could show, you know, the x-rays of the president, you know, the autopsy report. So Dr. Hume had done the original autopsy, and it had a different report than the FBI, so they said, well, where's your original one, you know? He said, I destroyed it by burning. I took it home, put it in the fireplace, and destroyed it by burning. When you want a patsy, you have to manipulate the evidence.
That's
it's very
true.
Part in
That's
every
true.
Conspiracy. You have the fall guy, you know, who becomes the patsy, and then you have to destroy or purge your witnesses, perjure, but your evidence is either destroyed in some way, or it's locked up, or it's missing.
I've accused him of manufacturing evidence, suborning perjury, perjuring.
Through the whole
different crimes, like it's about 5, 6, 8 crimes in the process of committing suppressing evidence that they have to do, usually manufacture different evidence, you know, to suppress the truth, you have to tell a lie.
So it's
Well,
you know, the important thing I think is like even these liberal lawyers, you had a copy of one down in L.A. and you wrote about the case and he said, well, because you've had a long narcotics arrest, or because you know these different arrest charges, your lawsuit that they damaged your personality or your future isn't effective because your past was such and such. Well, if a person can put his past behind him and educate himself and study law, study classics and literature, and put the old way behind and realize that it's not useful or constructive, then along comes this long list of things on your record. So if you wanted parole, if there were no Watergate story that broke, there was no scotch tape at the hotel, if these things hadn't come out, you probably would have been in prison for the rest of your life, because they'd say, here's a man who has had these arrests over a period of years, and then 35 burglaries in Beverly Hills, a narcotics user, never let him out. How would you ever get out if like he calls these professional criminals, you'd never get out?
This is the theme of Saxby's statement.
That's right.
This is what, and he's the Justice Department, U.S. government, and local law enforcement agencies are responsible for this attitude. They pay a lot of lip service to get the taxpayers' dollars about rehabilitation programs, but when you do, as you say, put narcotics and all behind you. And I had my law research career had begun to take momentum.
Uh-huh.
A federal judge had recommended me for a position with the legal aid. I'd worked with the legal aid. I'd worked with the Federal Public Defender's Office in Los Angeles. And at the time, I was to be a counselor at USC for a legal defense project. And mind you, even in spite of my past, so...
So when you were framed with another charge, like the parolee that was out, and they wanted to make sure you locked up for good, then you never could get out and use your legal work again. If there had been no Watergate, you probably never would get out.
I'd have been in now, I imagine, until I died.
Like some people are up there. Yeah. In our.
I'm just one, incidentally, on that note, I'm just one, depends on your point of view, one of the unfortunate or fortunate ones. It peaked, they discovered mine, there's so many others
that are in there
in these warehouses throughout the nation that that hasn't been brought to the attention of the public, and they've been victimized the same in the same manner that I have.
I know. Well, here we have our U.S. Henry Peterson of the Justice Department. This was that article you had from the August Sacramento Bee and the New York Times News Service, and they asked Mr. Peterson about the involvement of the White House and the plumbers in the Ellsberg doctor's robbery, and then he refers to you, and he says that they never did a checkup. He says, hindsight, looking back 2020 hindsight, I've asked myself 100 times why we didn't check this out. He says, we should have checked it out. But he says it wouldn't have mattered anyway because a burglar who had been caught erroneously confessed into Dr. Fielding's office. Now, the point is, like, Mr. Peterson of the Justice Department can tell Senator Tunney that you confessed. Doesn't the Justice Department ask you why you would confess? Doesn't it? I mean, instead of telling the news media that you confessed, or the Los Angeles Times far carries an article, oh, it's okay, he confessed. Here you go to the grand jury and say you didn't confess, but outside of myself and the news media, or a few people like Mark Schwartz at KPFA, don't these people come to you and want the story that you didn't confess?
He owed it to, with all the power behind him, Peterson that is, he owed it to the American citizen, not only to myself, but to the American citizen.
As an investigation.
To perform a thoroughgoing investigation.
That's right.
Yeah. So all this indicates the
collusion.
The collusion of it.
Well, this is what Tackett said, you know, that there was this collusion going on between the police department and the CIA, and the, you know, California criminal system. We know that many people in these prisons are framed like you. It's just that there's not going to be such a famous case. You know, you're associated with the world's most famous burglar here, entry, you know. And, oh, I just got some stationery made up. It says Elmer Davis, scapegoat for the world's most famous burglar. Because it's the one that brought Richard Nixon, the President of the United States, out of office and made a lot of changes, you know, or called attention to the fact that the CIA is planting disguises and cameras and in our local domestic scene that they're not supposed to do. And as your case develops, what stage is it in now, Davis versus Nixon? Now that you're out of Folsom Prison, what are the steps that you're going to have to do now?
Well, the judges ruled that I have to take the cause of action against both the federal and the state defendant, that is, the Beverly Hills police officers and John Ehrlichman, G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, and Crow, and various others, and former President Nixon. And we are going through the pre-trial phases. I had to get evidence like the arrest report. I had to have subpoenas issued. I had to have various summons issued on the various defendants, say, getting in and out of jail. Like, Gordon Liddy was just recently released, so I'll have to locate them. I'm having a problem.
Pinning them. The Justice Department won't help you with that either, will they?
They won't. Written the U.S. Marshal's Office and the Justice Department.
They won't serve the papers?
They placed various obstacles in my way, but it should pick up now that I'm out. I can do some of the things on my own.
Yeah. Well, we got about a half a minute here. We'll talk some more from time to time as the case keeps going. Elmer had his parole location moved from Long Beach to Carmel, California, and he's living here in the community. Guess who? You know, he's at my house, and he's with us, and we're going to be working together and writing together and keeping the case, keep it going. It'll be me and Elmer Davis versus Richard Nixon, all. Right,
that's
Elmer?
True, that's
true. Okay, well,
thanks for letting me.
Okay, take it easy. We'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
This has been done.